sleep and crap, where secrets lie in the border fires and the humming wires. Yeah, man, you know you're never coming back. Across the square, across the bridge, past the mills, past the stacks. On a gathering storm comes a tall, handsome man in a dusty black coat with a red right hand.
Dragon Ball Z, Dragon, Dragon, Run Dragon, come get me.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to this week's episode of Action for Everyone for this year, March 10th, 2024. I am, as always, your host, Mike Scott. I am getting over a week of being deathly ill. If you guys recall, we had a nasty windstorm last week and it kicked up so much shit that it gave me a sinus infection. So I've been homesick all week. I'm actually feeling like a normal human being today for the first time in a week. But I am here, joined, as always, by Vice Victus. Vice, how are you today?
We live in a twilight world. I'm kind of messed up right now. I'm discombobulated because we just did daylight savings time, so I lost that hour. I lost my sense of place in the universe. It's fucking weird, man. But yeah, I'm gonna get back on track with today's mighty podcast. As always, good to see you again.
good to be really quick. Are you guys hearing that beep when I mute, or is it just on my end?
No.
Okay. Good. All right. I was worried. All right. Good. So we'll edit that out. Anyway, or not, fuck it, we'll leave it in. We'll do it live. It's whatever. Liam is currently doing family stuff. He's at Universal and he's on Hollywood time. So he's going to try and join us at some point from the parking lot, but he's not here yet, but we couldn't wait around for him forever. This is what it's like. This is the producer director relationship. I'm always trying to get my director off the ass. We are also joined, hanging out in the background for the first time, but is going to be a regular presence. Producer Max Deering. Max, how are you today, bud?
I'm good. It is 5:17 in the afternoon, and I'm ahead of all of you because you got hit with daylight saving times, but I get at the end of the month. So we'll be a bit discombobulated for a while.
You're talking from the future. It's just crazy.
I still have the extra hour.
At least it's good to know the world is not going to die in the next 7 hours. So that's good. That's good at least. our guest host this week, he is hitting by far and away our most frequent one, Brandon Streisnig. Brandon, welcome back, bud.
Hey, so I was telling you off mic that the listeners won't be able to see this, but I'm hitting my five timers club SNL, and instead of a gold jacket, I decided I was finally going to go sleeveless for once. Finally join you guys.
for those who don't know, Brandon's got some actual fucking guns. What the hell, okay, dude?
I keep telling y'all, people online, so if y'all don't know, which you should by now, Brandon's like mad shit online. He's like mad shit. More than me. More than I ever could. And but like people like you, they always say, "Man, fuck you, buddy," whatever. I'm like, yo, listen, y'all don't know who you're talking to. The guy's built like a linebacker. Like he will fuck you up for real, man. Don't
they can come find me. They know where to find me. It's actually too cold to leave this shirt off though. So it's snowing.
Oh.
But I wanted to finally join the sleeveless club. I gotta get the sleeveless A4E shirt eventually. I'm a bad friend.
Yeah, no, you're good. I just put mine. I put mine actually away in a drawer because I'm like, as much as I am part of this show, I just am not gonna wear. Last summer I got like six tank tops and I haven't touched them since. So,
it's true. You got wearing a shirt with your own face on it to the gym. Oh man, that's a. It's a high.
It's kind of hard.
That is a flex.
That's an ego trip.
That is quite the flex.
You're like a pro wrestler. Like they all come out with their own face on their shirt and everything.
All right, we actually have a pretty packed show for you all today. It's going to be a little bit all over the place, but we got a lot of stuff to talk about. But first and foremost, we want to kind of talk about a little bit of sad news. Vice, I'm going to let you take it away.
Oh, yeah. So the big news that came out this week, the unfortunate passing of the mangaka slash anime legend, Akira Toriyama, who is probably most famous and known for being the creator of Dragon Ball and into it, Dragon Ball Z series. You know, it's an internationally famous series, kind of, and as people have been talking about over the past few days, really like kind of a game changer as far as like just media wise. Like, this is the kind of seminal work. All of his kind of contributions to media are like, these are the kind of things once in a generation, once in a lifetime, that literally changes the face of media. You know, he's influenced cartoons, comic books, movies, video games. Like, and you know, he's done actual work in all those fields, and that influence has been felt throughout over the generations now. Like literally, like people grow up and then have families, and they've been celebrating, experiencing, enjoying it, and celebrating his work for all these years. Yeah, so you know, it's been sad news of this past week, but at the same time, though, it's just really been, even with that sadness, just the outpour of love and appreciation for him has kind of been overwhelming, tremendous. You see it over social media from around the world, so many people from all walks of life, different countries, celebrating his memory. You really get a sense of how his work has been so powerful that different, I guess, cultures, regions kind of take his work into heart so uniquely. Like, for example, people here in America might not realize like how big Akira Toriyama and Dragon Ball is in Mexico, for example. It's almost like a national folk hero. You know? I've seen social media clips of this older, old Mexican dads showing off their Goku statues, and you see the little figurines next to the Virgin, the Guadalupe statues, or next to their Christ figures. Like it's that deep in the culture for some people that it's you know, it's a part of their lives, that has been a part of their lives forever, and now you know it's kind of going to go down in history as just kind of these really seminal, groundbreaking works of fiction, works of art, really. Because part of the reason why he's been so vocal is that he's a master artist. He has a way to make like simple, simple, immediately eye catching drawings like kids or like of just like cute characters, but he also does these really detailed, extravagant like mechanical designs. I think he has been respected and honored by other artists all over the world, specifically and also as well as him in his home culture and in his profession as a manga artist. You know, he was considered like the heir apparent, as the god of manga, and so just it's almost impossible to like kind of to start where to begin with his work, but the point of being that he's been so influential in everything that his influence is going to be felt for years to come, even after his passing. So yeah, we want to say a quick condolences to his family and just a shout out to his memory, because yeah, that's it's a living, that's just a legend, once in a lifetime.
Mike, you're muted still.
Why is nothing working today? Anyway, I'm not a Dragon Ball guy. As much as I like anime, I was a little too old for when Dragon Ball hit, and then because I was very much into like Macross and the Gyver and stuff like that, and then I kind of jumped to like Cowboy Bebop, but that like 90s, mid-90s period when Dragon Ball was really so formative for a lot of people, it missed me. But it's been very, very interesting to see, obviously, everybody online, the outpouring. So obviously, he had a massive effect on a lot of people and across a lot of generations and a lot of demographics. So it's definitely a big loss. Brandon, any thoughts on it for you?
I'm It's funny because like that's pretty much the only anime that I was super into as a kid, which I think is probably true of a lot of like people around my age. I think like that and Pokemon, like if you ever did get into anime, those were like the two big crossovers. But I loved I'm getting into anime more now as I get older, but I loved Dragon Ball when I was a kid and a teen, and just like my whole life I've like circled around it and everything, and it just yeah, like Vegeta was like my first favorite character in any medium. Like it just like I mean I'm sure there was stuff when I was like a kid, but like Vegeta was the first like obsession I had. And I never got too much into like GT, but I don't think he was involved in GT if I'm not mistaken. I Vice, you might know that better than me,
Yeah,
but
it's really like very loosely. Yeah, loosely.
yeah, so Dragon Ball and Dragon Ball Z were like the two that I was really into. And as I've gotten older, I've really like kind of circled back into loving Dragon Ball the most. Like I was actually rereading some of it last year. Just like I love how simple and like the and just kind of like low key that is compared to like Z. And I love the art style in Dragon Ball so much. And yeah, he just it's funny, like I hadn't really thought about it, but that was probably one of the first big like just in general, probably one of the first like favorite things I ever had was Dragon Ball Z. It's like T-shirts, action figures, everything. I remember like trading action figures with kids at school and everything. Like it just we were all obsessed with it. It's huge loss.
Yeah, and like part of the thing about his influence is that his influence has been so widespread that and, you know, I mentioned before, like the Japanese artist in the various fields kind of look to him as like a icon and have a direct influence. But even like and like with that generational kind of crossover you mentioned, it's his work is so widespread that it's almost difficult to even kind of enumerate how influential he is. But just one example is that you know, things like The Matrix, you know, the Wachowskis, they've often credited him as like, Dragon Ball specifically as part of his influence. Like, you know, the scene in like part three where he's there, Agent Smith and Neo are fighting in the air, like doing kung fu fighting in the air. Like that's direct Dragon Ball Z reference. Now with that's the way that's kind of staged and shot. So he, and in the world of video games, again, he's been a designer for various video game characters. But even then, like the way his storytelling goes, the kind of the arc he makes that's been felt throughout, you know, people like, you know, Hideo Kojima, famous for Metal Gear, you know, cite him as an influence. Yeah, just so many. Yeah, it's literally too many things to name, or too many people to name that he've directly influenced. So yeah, just if like I said, well, if people aren't, well, it's like it's probably funny. You might not realize you're familiar with his work. But it's more likely you actually are, you just don't know it yet. So yeah, I recommend, you know, taking you know, if you look through social media again, like it's, and just kind of look up Toriyama, like you'll see through all this the praise he's been getting, like what some of the very likely some of your favorite works, you know, comic books, even, you know, American, you know, Western animation all have influences from him. So
Well, that's actually one of the big things that I know is for me, you know, Dragon Ball was really one of the first manga to really do really steer into decompressed fighting scenes where, you know, one fight will take five issues. And that is both awesome and infuriating. But like I said, I jumped a gap, and one of the anime that got me back into anime pretty hard was Bleach. Bleach is one of my absolute favorite, and Bleach is very much you know, following the Dragon Ball Shonen template. It's massive story arcs, hundreds of characters, fights that take, you know, three episodes. Like, and so yeah, it's very clearly, you know, I mean, even the big three, sort of the big three shonen, you know, from the 2000s that people call the big three, Bleach, Naruto, and One Piece, all really have their DNA in Dragon Ball. I mean, it's very clear that those are all following, absolutely following Dragon Ball templates. And yes, there was shonen manga before Dragon Ball, but it definitely has built a template for a lot of what we're seeing now with, you know, stuff that shows up in Shonen Jump and stuff like that. So
Yeah,
I
and to that
hadn't.
point, to that point, real quick, just people, if you're familiar with manga, you probably know the name Osamu Tezuka. Basically, he's considered the godfather of manga, basically the creator of the shonen or manga template as we know it. And he passed years ago. And but in during his lifetime, he had, you know, when Toriyama was coming up, he had said outright that Toriyama was, in his words, the heir apparent. Like he was, and he said, I think it was almost too good. Like he pretty much, bequeathed to him the title of the king of manga. And like, yeah, like, you can just imagine that, like, imagine, like, I don't know, like John Ford or like someone saying you're the next great director. So, it's like being knighted by Spielberg. That's like the kind of the scale of how big his power was, that the godfather of manga himself crowned him to be the greatest. And again, like all the artists nowadays, they recognize as such that, he was the king before we know it.
It hadn't really occurred to me until his passing, but there's a big film Twitter guy, Mr. Chow. I'm sure he has the Bugs Bunny profile picture. He tweeted about this, and I hadn't thought about it, but I think he's right. I think Goku might be like the most recognizable fictional character, like more so than maybe Superman or Spider-Man. Like I think Go there's a case for Goku to be made, like case to be made for Goku to be like one of like the most instantly recognizable iconic characters. It's pretty insane. Like he left an insane contribution to the world just with that alone. Like,
Yeah, and like it's all, like I mentioned the cultural impact of it all, like I guess like Mexico has this like really like obsession with Goku. Like you'll see his picture like on taco stands, like he's the angry. But even like here in America, it's our own unique thing where like it's just like during that kind of wave of when anime kind of took over America or became widespread, like even though these are like these crazy characters in this wild fictional like alt world and like a lot of, well, speak from my experience, like a lot of minority, like black kids and Mexican kids, Hispanic kids, like it was so influential towards Dragon Ball. And so like it's hard to explain, but like basically like there's so many ways you can like read some of like our experience onto some of the characters. Like the big thing, like people maybe not here, is that Piccolo, he's Piccolo, the character, he's a green, he's yeah, Piccolo is black, but
Piccolo's
he's a green alien, but like he's like he coded it black, as it were. And it's not likely that Toriyama meant that per se, but like just the attitude and how he's been received over the years, like that the way his characters have this like dimension and depth to them, that people from all the world can like kind of see them themselves in this, like in these wild characters. And yeah, it's just that influence is like you can't really, that's one of a kind you can't really replicate. Like that's how special his artwork is, that people from you got kind of disparate worlds, almost literally, can find themselves in it, his work. It's really great.
It says so much that we all apparently had the same Goku shirt from Hot Topic, the button down, you standing there super stable. I vividly remember having that as a kid. And I share it because someone had told about it. I actually, just a very brief aside with me, like Vice, like so many others, I grew up with DBZ on Toonami. Toonami was like the mainstay, Saturday nights, weekend night, weeknights, that sort of thing. And I remember watching DBZ, and then it would either be that, and then Justice League or Batman, one of the DC animated shows. But my mom, when I was younger, she used to work at a jewelry store, and I remember, when I didn't have school or something, she would take me with her, and I'd just sit in the back all day. And I had a copy of Broly, the first Broly movie, and that was sort of my intersection between anime, Dragon Ball Z, and then nu metal, because it has got some nu metal up there that I still listen to this day. So it's very funny. And I shared that clip on Twitter of the cooler fight, and they used Deftones in it, and it's just that fascinating intersection between all these things of, like Vice was saying, black identity, anime, Japanese culture, and then also 2000s nu metals. It's insane, and it worked well too. It's
Yeah,
great.
like all the kind of fan-made AMVs, the anime music videos that people made of Dragon Ball with, like Trapped or like Disturbed, like but like even then, even that, like that was like a key, one of the key parts, factors of like the boom of the internet. Like people were able to share their art, like that's kind of like before YouTube was even a thing. People making these videos to like kind of their own like independent creations, just kind of smashing these things together, like this crazy soundtracks. in this anime. Again, and again, like he's like, the internet is what it is in part because of like Dragon Ball Z
movies. Yeah, I really do wonder how many like current editors, like big time editors in Hollywood and working in movies, like cut their teeth on anime AMVs, right? like 2005, they're cranking out anime AMVs. You know, before even YouTube, you fucking went on IRC and downloaded that shit. Like, yeah, like
Vice, you're unlocking so many memories for me that I haven't thought about in years and years. But like, this is such a funny one. But like, speaking of people creating their own art based around Dragon Ball, I remember like looking for Dragon Ball websites as a kid, and like I came upon one. It was like GeoCities site or an Angel Fire site, and it was like a black artist who had recreated all the characters as black characters, and the website was called theblackgoku.com. And
I remember that.
See, I was hoping I wasn't the only one, but that just popped back in my head, and I just remember being obsessed with that because I was like, it was like the coolest website I ever found, and like, yeah, like that. That show or Dragon Ball is just like so many early memories for me. It was the first controller I ever threw through a wall when I was a kid, playing Budokai and getting knocked out of the world tournament by Mr. Satan. And like, yeah, just so much of my early childhood or early to middle childhood is just wrapped up in that.
And another like a kind of what seems like a underrated memory, but I think so. Like, you know, well, if you're an action movie fan, you might probably aware of anime, maybe you might not be a fan of it though. But like another part of this is like the way this how culture and media has worked has evolved. Even back then during like, you know, with the rise of home entertainment, and, you know, again, like I mentioned the internet kind of influence, but even like then, like I remember my first memory of Dragon Ball was in maybe 93, 94 when they had these anime OVAs, like 40 minute movies. And so before Dragon Ball actually first officially aired broadcast on official TV, they had a bunch of bootlegs being sold, you know, around my way in New York and Lake Avenue, and you know throughout the world, of those fan subbed movies, and like and just the way it kind of this as it applies to like just being a film lover or being a cinephile, like and specifically an action movie fan, like that same kind of that same process of going to this big avenue and find the bootleg of Dragon Ball. It's like, you know, like it's like sacred, weird, obscure text. That's also how I found on the same shelf. That's when I saw A Duel to the Death, and you know, another fan subbed, you know, but it's, you know, of course, a legendary martial arts film. Like, and that's again, that's kind of that cultural nexus where stuff like Dragon Ball is that it kind of opened these doors for all kinds of stuff, you know, be it, you know, music or new metal or whatever, or like just action film or international cinema. Like I would say, like, you know, like that a lot of people's probably the first foreign film they saw, quote unquote, was a Dragon Ball, you know, a bootleg AMV or a bootleg a movie or OAV. Like that's, people don't think about when you say foreign film or international cinema, you know, you get the stereotype of like, you know, the what is it, the sad, boring Eastern European movie. But no, like Dragon Ball OVAs, those are technically, you know, foreign films. You know, that just when you recognize that, you can see how, again, the scope of his influence is far beyond just his art, like just being influenced by the art, like it's the culture he helped be a part of. So like I said, like the more you think about it, the more you kind of step back, you can see how much he's influenced so much of worldwide media culture, and it's really insane. Yeah. So yeah, just again, you know, just RIP to him and to him, and it's just once in a lifetime thing. But even though he's gone, like his work's gonna live forever. So I'm very happy with that. You know?
Yeah, RIP. It's a big loss, but obviously also leaves one hell of a legacy. So you know, I mean, you can't be too upset about it just because, you know, the man will live on forever at this point.
I don't even think someone like Spielberg or like Carpenter, when they pass, even they won't, I don't know, have touched as many cultures and touchstones as much as he has.
No, you're talking, I mean, we're talking literally like Walt Disney level cultural, you know, legacy. So yeah, absolutely. All right. Well, moving on. So as much as we love Brandon, and as much as I love bringing him on because it pisses off his haters, of which he has many, you know, every time somebody gives Brandon shit, I like to invite him on the show. It's just the way it works. But nonetheless, you're actually here for a reason, B. We brought you on specifically to talk about the second annual Vulture Stunt Awards. You guys went hardcore this year, did an entire digital issue. So tell us a little bit about how it, you know, what you're at liberty to discuss in terms of how it came together. And then we'll obviously get into the awards and some of the other stuff in a few minutes.
Well, how it came together was pretty much the same as last year. My editor, like around November-ish, October, was like, hey, let's get started, start sending out emails. And it's always so funny, like when I look back at like it feels weird saying like, oh, I worked so hard on this, it's exhausting. But then I look at all the emails I sent and I'm like, yeah, that is exhausting. But it's just email after email. And the action issue was New York Magazine was so happy about how last year turned out, just the Stunt Awards by themselves, that they were like, we want to devote an entire day or week rather, I guess, to action. And I'm hoping that that continues going forward. I mean, the media landscape with film writing is like dying, so who knows next year, you know, hopefully Vulture, I keep hoping every year that Vulture will continue to exist just for this, but it was really cool to see that happen. And I didn't have like the Stunt Awards are like, I guess the way my editor described it to me, they're like my baby, so like I didn't have a whole lot of input on the planning of the action issue, but I did know a lot of like what went into it, and it was really fun to see it all come together. I mean, there's so much in there that I was just like blown away by. Like one of my favorite articles was Allison Wilmore wrote all about the thigh crush, that, you know, and that was a lot of fun to read. And Roxana Haddadi did a really incredible interview with Sophia Batella, like an extended long interview. I don't think I've ever seen anyone get her to open up that much. It was a really cool interview. Jake Gyllenhaal was our cover star in anticipation for Roadhouse. There's a lot of cool stuff. The one that I contributed the most to, other than the Stunt Awards, were the 100 most, or not, what was the title of the article? It's embarrassing. The 100 Fights That Shaped Cinema, which was received well, but I knew going into a project like that was going to be faced with some contention. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, let's not hide behind the curtain here. A list like this, by definition, is generated to create contention.
Sure.
An editor somewhere is saying, let's stir some people up. Let's I don't want to say that these lists are in bad faith, because I don't think they are, but there's definitely a commerce component, a capitalistic component.
Sure.
To them. So I hope people understand that when you know somebody's involved in a list like this, it isn't necessarily just that, you know, we're trying to piss people off, but we kind of are, you know.
Yeah, no, that was like, without, you know, I actually don't know how much I am allowed to say, like, the impetus behind things, but there were some conversations like, well, what if we include this fight? That's kind of trolling, isn't it? And then a response would be like, well, yeah, but we kind of want to be a little trolly with this one, like we want to get people looking at it. So like there is like a balance to be had with that. And to be honest, working on a list like this did give me a lot of good insight into that kind of process, because it made me appreciate more how much work actually goes into it. Like I was telling you guys before we started that it was like almost 2 months of like weekly or bi-weekly Zoom calls where we would have like knockdown drag out fights of our own, like with a lot of writers. Like for me, it was kind of crazy to pop on a Zoom call and see like a handful of writers that I've like grown up like reading and respecting, and then all of a sudden I'm fighting with them because I want to include Transformers Dark of the Moon. but it was a lot of fun putting that kind of list together. You know, of course, you know, I'd have my quibbles. I wish it wasn't so Western based, but I mean, I think unless the exact right people are working on a list like this, I think it's always going to be Western based, which is unfortunate. But we did, I will say, we did our absolute best trying to get writers and experts from all walks of like film, like animation, Indian cinema, to try and weigh in where our blind spots were. So I hope we covered everything, but on the whole, I was very proud of that list. That was a lot of fun to put that together.
I mean, it can definitely be quibbled with, I think, but on the whole, it's a solid list, especially given I thought it was a very, very smart decision for you guys to do it in chronological order. Even though I was eagerly waiting for people to miss that, and they sure did. But you know, I thought that was the smartest way to do it. Because I mean, all of these movies are important. There's not one on this list that I'm like, yeah, are there ones that I think should be on instead of some of the others? Absolutely, but there's not one on this list that I'm like, I just don't get that. I don't get what they were thinking putting that one on the list. And that's hard enough to do in and of itself, to create a list where you can look and go, look, do we knock this out of the park on everyone? No, but is everyone at least a ground rule double? Yeah, you know, and that's kind of how I feel like with a lot of this list is. Maybe it's not what I would pick, but you can't really. Plus, I mean, you got Universal Soldier Day of Reckoning on there. It's automatically the best list in the world.
I fought for that one. The two ones I fought for the most were that one. Well, aside from Dark of the Moon, which I knew was going to be an early elimination, but I fought for that, and I fought for Sudden Death because I just the whole Pittsburgh thing, and I do think that is an influential fight. It's one of my favorite Jean-Claude Van Damme fights for sure. But
I also love that you have the last fight from Warrior on there too. That one made me really happy. The only fight that is guaranteed to make me burst into tears every time I watch it.
Well, putting it together also was a good reason for me to check out some stuff I hadn't seen. Like a few people were very insistent on I'm going to be real here and say I didn't read through the full list yet because I've been so busy this week, but I can't remember if Rob Roy made it or not, but a lot of people were very insistent on Tim Roth versus Liam Neeson and Rob Roy, and I was like I couldn't understand it, but I went and watched the fight, and I was like, oh, this is pretty incredible. I had never even, it's embarrassing to say, but I mean, I've heard of the Rob Roy story, but I had never heard of that specific movie. So that was kind of fun to like seek stuff out that was I was unfamiliar with while putting this together.
Which again is also kind of one of the, you know, one of the goals of a list like this is to, you know, I think people get so mad, and I fall victim to it too. I get mad at lists like this all the time. Like it's just in our nature. But because I think the problem is we're not approaching these lists. It's not in our nature to approach these lists as this is an opportunity for me to expand my horizons and maybe get turned on to some movies that I had never thought about before. We go into it wanting confirmation bias. We want this list to completely conform to what we think the best movies are. And when we don't get that confirmation bias, that's when we get pissed off. You know, that's really. We all approach these lists. And like I said, I'm no saint here. I'm no fucking angel on this. I do it all the time too. We approach these lists completely in the wrong way as readers. We take them in only wanting to see the movies that we want to see, which is what's the fucking point of that? Make your own goddamn list then. Then you get confirmation bias every time you read it, right? Like it's such an insecure way to approach a list as opposed to looking over it like this and being like, you know, especially, you know, because you guys go all the way back to the dawn of cinema. I mean, there's shit. The first 30 entries are movies that most people have never seen, let alone, you know, probably never even heard of. And so, you know, it is a good list for that. But yeah, so all in all, I think you guys did a really good job.
Well, thank you. Yeah, it was really fun to put that together. I'm already thinking about like what lists could we do for next year, if that comes to pass. I'm already excited about that. Maybe 100 best gunfights. So that way, leaving John Woo off, this one, we can make up for it next year.
Oh, these remind me. I just I got a some dweeb was like I this list has things that John Woo has influenced, but not John Woo itself. Like, well, I can't take it seriously. But then I was like, this is a John Woo doesn't really do fights like that. He does a gunfight. He doesn't do like fist fights. You know, like as per the criteria of the list itself. I'm like, get a grip, dude. Relax.
Yeah, like that was a big thing, is like we put it in the parameters, like it can't really involve guns. Like it can involve maybe swords or something like that, but like guns, I feel like is a bridge too far. And so yeah, maybe that's what I'll pitch for next year is 100 greatest gunfights, and then we can get John Woo all over it. And
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, sorry, go ahead, Vice.
Well, I just want to switch gears a little bit because I wanted to talk about one of the other parts of the issue. Well, because I just realized I remembered that tonight is the Oscars, apparently. So a lot of people are looking forward to that, I guess. But I just wanted to commend you specifically on this year's Stunt Awards overall, because as we kind of suspected or expected, John Wick 4 kind of swept the awards for the 2023 action overall. In the various categories, like speaking like gunfight, for example, is one of them. But yeah, it was cool to see. Like, I really appreciated the scope of the nominees, and there were even still a few surprises too. Because the biggest and heavy surprise for me was the best non stunt in a non action movie. That's from No Hard Feelings, Jennifer Lawrence. As I call it, the titty suplex, the nude beach fight. Because again, like I posted this months ago, like it's a hilarious gag on his face, just like a naked woman like beating up a bunch of teenagers. But at one point, like when she does this suplex, and like it's perfect. It's like professional wrestling level, like perfect. Yeah, it's part of the fun of doing these awards that you kind of to recognize that when we say recognize the great work of stunt people, we kind of inherently think about the big gunfights, explosions, car chases, that kind of stuff. But yeah, even there's so many stunts are a part of so many kinds of movies that are even action related. And like it's really great that you had this list, and I guess the series overall, to recognize that on all fronts. Like I know Bottoms, the crazy comedy was also part of that nominees. It has a really cool fight, and that, even though it's like a crazy ass like high school comedy.
Well, I appreciate that, because that's category specifically is my favorite of all of them, because it does, like you said, point out stunt work that we might just forget about or not even notice, because it's such a wide breadth of craft that you forget that it's not just action movies. And I like too, because like I knew John Wick was going to sweep everything. Like it just, when I saw that movie, I was like, yeah, there's no way. But I liked that. I think you pointed it out on Twitter, Mike. It might have been you. We do try to, in our write-up of each winner, try to highlight all of the nominees the best we can, because I think, like, especially in a year like this where it's all John Wick across the board, I was tasked with writing about best fight and best aerial stunt and stunt performer of the year. And in my write-up of best fight, I really tried to specifically call out Luna Fujimoto for Sniper Grit, because, not to go too far behind the curtain here, but she came in second place by, like, a fairly close margin when you consider it was Donnie Yen who won. Like it was, so it's really cool to like that she got so much support, because that fight is incredible.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I like most about it is to me it's nicest to actually read the article, because it's so in depth on the nominees, on the ones that don't win, and a good articulation of why the one that won. I mean, I said this, I became a broken record when this came out, when it dropped, that when everybody was like kind of upset that John Wick swept, I was just, my routine, my mantra was, sometimes the obvious choice is the correct choice. I mean, there just is no, even though, like I said, I ended up voting for Extraction 2 in almost everything. I can't possibly look at a movie like John Wick 4 and be upset. It's like when Return of the King swept the Oscars, and it's like, look guys, sometimes the obvious choice is the correct choice here. Sometimes the best fucking action movie is just the best fucking action movie, and that's all that happens. Like, we should be looking at it that we were blessed to get a movie like John Wick 4 this year, that is that fucking incredible.
Well, and speaking of Extraction, I'm not exaggerating here. It was like deadline, like last couple hours of voting decision where Oppenheimer ended up overtaking it in the explosive award. Like Extraction was winning almost the whole way through, and I was kind of excited about it, because like I think we included one of the quotes in the article that someone said their reason for voting was that they legit lit Chris Hemsworth's arm on fire, which, like, that's cool in and of itself. Like,
That sounds like me. I can't remember if that was me, but that absolutely sounds like something I would have written.
But yeah, like lighting a movie star on fire. I mean, as impressive as Oppenheimer was, like I voted for Extraction. I'll say it.
And I was also happy to see, you pulled in Best Shootout, you pulled a quote on the channel, because
Yeah.
that was the one that I, it's not my quote, but that's, I was happy to see that I wasn't the only one that voted for the channel, that, it's William Kaufman, So again, I knew the channel wasn't going to win. There was no chance in a year with John Wick 4 that the channel was going to win Best Shootout, but I loved that. It still got highlighted, and people reading the article are going to be like, what the fuck is this movie, The Channel? But
I
fucking
hope so.
Sniper, some
Yeah.
movie called Sniper Grit got
That's
nominated. What the fuck is this?
the thing I'm most proud of is that I'm getting a publication like Vulture and New York Magazine to talk about Sniper Grit in the channel. Like that's all I care about. Like if someone who reads that site who doesn't normally care about action movies sees those titles and, like you said, are like, what the fuck are these? Then that's like my job is done.
Also, I mean, think of it as John Wick sweeping the Stunt Awards. Think of it as a recompense for not getting a single Oscar. I mean, they don't have a Stunt
Agreed.
Awards
Yeah.
in the Oscars as well, but like, think of it as like that. But
I agree with you. Like I saw it, I missed two of the Best Picture nominees. But I truly believe that like John Wick 4 is like on a craft level and just as a movie, like better than almost all of the nominees except for like Killers of the Flower Moon. But I'm also not as high on all the nominees as everyone else this year. But I think John Wick 4 is just a legitimately great movie, and it's just, I don't know, it's a bummer that
Yeah, but that's also the thing with the Oscars. They don't really care that much about the craft in of itself.
Right. I
And
mean, they've been spending the last few years trying to not even televise those awards. So, yeah.
So Godzilla minus one sweep, that's all that matters. All right, I'm out.
I do love the quote from Godzilla Minus One that what was it, the quote that you guys pulled? I can't believe a fucking nuclear lizard movie had me in genuine tears.
Well, here, one more thing I wanted to highlight is I guess, well, before I'm glad that thank you for getting some of my quotes in this article as well. I know I got one of mine for one of the it's one category I wanted to talk with about is the Lifetime Achievement Award. You had a lot of like great professionals who have done work over the years. That was really cool. I saw well, he wasn't the winner, but one of the nominees was Marco Zaror. And I got shout out to myself, I guess. I don't know. I got my little blurb about him, because like when he did Fist of the Condor, basically he created a brand new martial arts style. Like that's what he did. So I was really glad like I was able to get that, my impressions of that and his work out, to a wide audience. But I wanted to talk to you about the actual winner. I haven't finished reading the article because it's so in depth. But the Henry Kingsley, like he's this this is one of the most fascinating stories I've ever read, like so far. Like this, his the I don't know, just his story is incredible. Like he's actually he's like a seminal figure in the in like just not the story of stunt performers, but like in cinema.
Yeah.
We spoke to like like Louis Philip Tan, and like we got great stories from him. Like and talking to people like that, I'd never even realized the depth of knowledge that these OGs have about Hollywood in general, but and action movies specifically. But just reading through Henry's stories it's incredible. It's wow. Can you just talk about like how that came about, like how you all the stuff you got out of him? That's just so wow.
So last year we went with Albert Pyun for many reasons. One was, he had passed and I wanted to write about him and, his impact on, just that kind of stuff. But this year we were trying to figure out who we should go with, and there were some big names that we were thinking of and everything. And then he kind of came across our, I don't know what word I'm looking for, but like his name popped up and I started reading into him and I was like, this is the kind of guy that we should be honoring, like not just kind of guy, but like kind of person that we should be honoring with a Lifetime Achievement Award, because he, like you said, he runs through like 50, 60 years of like cinema history and he's still working. I mean, it's
It's
nuts. Like
crazy.
he's when he started, black stunt performers weren't really even allowed to work. Like they were painting white stunt performers in scenes, and like that was in the 60s, which like I know like it's this is such a cliche thing to say at this point, you know, with all the like many reckonings we've been doing over the years, but like it is just crazy to think about that the 60s were not that long ago and that was still happening. Like that feels like something you would read about from the silent era, but it's like it wasn't. And he was like instrumental in helping change that. He created the Black, or he co-created the Black Stuntman's Association, which, as he was telling me that about that, it wasn't even just getting opportunities for stuntmen. He started to go into they would advocate for black makeup artists and black hairstylists, you know, to make up black people, you know, to look the right way on screen, or to, you know, do the hair the right way. So they were advocating for more than just black stunt performers, and it's just crazy because like he started back then, and then, you know, last year he was working on Fast X and the Continental, and he's like 80 years old and he's still driving, and it's like just and everyone who I spoke to about him, particularly Craig Baxley, who sent me a lovely email, like a lovely like speech that unfortunately, you know, I wanted to include his whole little spiel, but we had to cut it down a little bit, but. He just everyone said that Henry is just like the most unassuming guy you would never expect it, but when he gets behind like the wheel, it's just like pulls off some of the craziest shit. Like it's in the article, so I don't want to, I guess I don't want to give away too much because, you know, I want people to read it, but his story about working on Bad Boys 2 is nuts. Like he almost died, and it's just like crazy, and it was a freak thing, but he just, I don't know. And the other thing I'll say about it is I had no idea. Like when you watch Fast X, I always assumed the vault, not Fast X, Fast Five, I always assumed the vault was CG. And to find out that he was in a pickup truck inside like a real vault that they built around the pickup truck is just nuts to me. Like that's the kind of stunt work that I never consider, that I just blows my mind when you're like, when he was telling me that story, I'm just like, this is incredible. Like you would have never even imagined. And they could have gone CG, but he said a big reason they didn't was his first Fast movie was Fast and Furious, and he, the stunt team and the director all hated the way the CG turned out in that movie, and they were like, we want to make as much as Fast Five as real as possible. So that started with the vault scene, and it just, I found that really incredible.
Yeah, that guy's like living legend, living history. That's I get definitely like you said, like please if even if you know the Star Wars and all the articles are great, but like that, I think as a film fan, if you're listening, like this is like real history that's like almost secret history in a way. Like that I think it's really important that people read about because you know this craft that we love, like there's a lot of there's so many obstacles that people have to overcome to get to make it what it is. And so yeah, this is definitely like you know it lives up to the titling. This is like a lifetime achievement. Like this is like one hell of a lifetime that lives. See what this guy's done is insane.
It was cool talking to him too, because I felt like my own journey through film and TV, like talking to him, because even something like as small as like we talked about his kids a little bit, and he had two kids with Lindsay Wagner, who was the Bionic Woman, and she is like one of my dad's heroes along with Lee Majors, and like, and it just was so cool to be talking to the guy who was married to the Bionic Woman, and it's like, you know, I grew up watching Bionic Woman with my dad and everything, and like I don't know, just so much about him. Like he did all the driving pretty much on the A team. Like anytime you see the A team van doing crazy shit, that was him. And like, yeah, just so much stuff like that you just wouldn't even know. So as much as I loved writing about Albert Pyun last year, he's one of my favorite filmmakers. I'm just like, I mean, we had that whole episode about him and everything, but he means the world to me. This was honestly maybe even more fulfilling to just like, this guy is as important to the history of like cinema as like any actor or director. So yeah, like it just was really cool to hear his story. We talked for like almost 2 hours on the phone, and so I could only fit so much in, but I have a recording on my computer of just like one of the best interviews I've ever done. I asked maybe five questions in total because he just talked forever, and I was just sitting there like, holy shit, I can't believe I'm hearing all this. This is crazy.
You know, that's one of the things, because I read the article, I thought it was amazing. But one of the things that I always realize with this show, because people always ask us, how do we get, you know, the guests that we get and how do we get them to talk so much? It's most of these guys, they want to tell their stories. They're happy to tell their stories. Just nobody's fucking asking them. You know, nobody sat down and asked Henry King, tell me your life story, until, you know, you guys did it. Like, and so that's a thing. There's stories there. You want to know what happens on movie sets. You talk to the stunt people, because they got their finger on the pulse of every fucking thing that goes on a movie set. And, you know, there's been plenty of shit that we haven't aired in episodes and stuff. You know, I can only imagine you got some stuff too.
Oh, yeah.
You. Yeah. You know, but it was great. And it was, I thought it was a well-deserved honor. And I know there's some real obvious choices, you know, out there, that your Jackie Chans and your Sammo Hungs and your John Woos and people like that. But it's nice that for 2 years in a row now, the Lifetime Achievement Award has gone to somebody that isn't known very well by the general populace. You know, for those who don't remember, last year it was Albert Pyun. And so, you know, this year you get Henry King, and I hope that kind of continues. I hope that you guys really do use this, because as much as I love Jackie Chan, as much as I love John Woo, do they really need more fucking accolades?
Exactly.
Like, do they really need more praise heaped upon them?
That was a little bit of the conversation we were having, because, like, I know on the ballot we put an option for you to vote, like, for who you think should lifetime achievement, like your suggestion. But we usually, my editor and Bilga Abiri, who's another huge component of this, it's like he and I are like really like working like together on a lot of this. It's usually a conversation between us at the end of the day, like, who do we want to honor? And for a long time, it was going to be John Woo this year, especially because Silent Night was coming out. You know, I know a lot of people didn't like that movie, but it did feel like a little bit of a comeback and everything. So it was like, yeah, let's do John Woo. But as it was going, we were like, well, I mean, Bilga had just interviewed John Woo not that long ago, and it just felt like, you know, everyone knows John Woo, everyone knows his story. I mean, like you said, there's been so much ink spilled on him. So the conversation shifted into like, why don't we do something like this instead? And that's what I'm going to keep trying to keep that going. The Lifetime Achievement Award is basically my article every year now, as far as I've been told. So I'm going to do my best to keep it as, you know, someone telling their story or writing about someone's story, in Albert Pune's case, that isn't widely available. Because I think that's more important than, you know, the 90 millionth article about Jackie Chan.
Yeah, I kind of think if you have more than one book written about you and it's written by people other than our friend Justin DeClue, you probably can wait to get your Lifetime Achievement Award, right? like that's the whole thing is, you know, Pune's got the one book that was Justin's passion project. Henry King doesn't even have a book. Like, these are people that are fascinating, and that I'm not going to learn anything new about Jackie Chan at all. Like, ever again, as long as I live, I'm not going to learn anything new about Jackie Chan. It's all been written. And so it's like, use this as an opportunity to educate and introduce people. So I love it. I thought it was great. I thought you guys absolutely knocked it out of the park again this year. You know, we always joke about film writing. It's a push and pull, right? Because sometimes Vulture puts out articles that just make me smack my head, you know, and stuff like that. But on the flip side, like, this is 2 years in a row, I think you guys have just absolutely killed it. I know our friend Jordan Cruciola works on it too.
Yeah, she was a huge part of it this year. She helped out a lot, and I definitely want to shout her out.
Yeah, and again, love you, Jordan. We need to get Jordan back on actually one of these days. So we haven't had her on for a long time. But love you, Jordan.
I also want to thank her very briefly, just because I love my editor. My editor's name is Catherine Brooks. She's working with her has been great these last years, but she's so spread thin that sometimes, let's just say she might miss an email, and it might be an important email, and I don't have it in me to be aggressive, but Jordan and I were in an email thread together, and like, Catherine didn't see, Kate, she goes by Katie. Katie didn't see this exchange, but Jordan and I were going back and forth on like, I we need an answer on this. And Jordan is much more prone to be like, hey, we need a fucking answer. Like, thank you, Jordan.
Jordan? No, really? Not our Jordan. Sweet Jordan. I've never.
Jordan
I would
emailed me.
never.
Jordan emailed me and was like, "I have a lot of experience with this. I'll get our answer for us." And I was like, "Thank you so much, because I don't have it in me to start, like pounding." And I should, because that's how you get shit done. But thank you, Jordan. And Katie, if you're listening, you're probably not. It's all love. I know how spread thin you are. Like, no worries.
If you haven't read it, read it. Read the whole article. If you don't subscribe to Vulture, you can get, a trial subscription and check it out. They are doing great work, but especially this year. We talked about when you were on how many more votes you got this year. I mean, eventually, if this keeps going, it is going to put enough pressure on the powers that be at the other awards to start taking this seriously.
I hope so. I know Stahelski, when I interviewed him, shouted this out as like, when we were talking, he said, like, "I'm a big fan of your work." And like, he said that to me unprompted. And I was like, "Oh shit." And like, and he told me that he's been at like a lot of meetings with the Academy talking about this. And I, from what I understand from the people I've spoken to, the biggest hurdle is who do you give the award to?
Right.
And yeah. And it's just
Because
like, oh, good.
No, go ahead. I'll come in after.
Oh, just that's been the and that's been a problem we've had, is like, do you give it to the stunt choreographer? Do you give it to the person performing the stunt? It's like, and I think you should just have a blanket like stunt team, but I mean,
Yeah, when
like,
something wins best picture, who do you give it to? You give it to the
exactly.
fucking movie. There's no reason you can't. Is that what you were gonna say, Max? Is that
No, it was there was a tweet probably about a month ago, and I saw it, and I kind of agreed with it, where they said the reason they won't make a stunt award is because that would mean that the film has to be worthy of being like best picture, or something like that. I
And that's so lame. Yeah.
Because that would mean they would have to acknowledge that this film, let's say John Wick 4, for instance, would have to be as worthy as Oppenheimer or Anatomy of a Fall or The Zone of Interest, which
Or
it is, but they.
fucking Suicide Squad, Oscar winning Suicide Squad. Like, that's a that is not a good
Best
argument.
makeup. Best
Yeah,
makeup. Yeah.
like it is a technical component, just like costume, production design, sound design, and makeup. So there's no reason you couldn't nominate something that maybe isn't like take something like Broken Path, right? My beloved Broken Path. Look, that movie is not an Oscar winner on any level, except I would put it up for stunts if it came out this year. It absolutely, I mean, there's only so many buildings you can throw Johnny Young Bosch off of before like you have to like give it credit where it's due. So,
But then the question I also have is, let's say hypothetically tonight they spring on us Best Stunt Awards at the Oscars. Do we not also know that the second they come up with that award, they're definitely going to just shuffle it to the side, just like they do best visual effects, best sound,
Oh,
So
sure.
then it's like we've got the recognition, but they're still not going to, they won't give it the time of day like they'll give best actor, best
And the
actress.
you and that's a good point too. It's crazy, because every year we hear about, oh, no one's watching the Oscars anymore. What's going on? And it's like they tried to fix it with the best cheer moment that, the Flash, or not the Flash, Zack Snyder won and everything. And they try to fix it every year by doing different things. And it's like, could you imagine how exciting it would be to have like a little stunts presentation with to go along with the nominees? I don't know, maybe not performing stunts, although that would be kind of fun. Pull out like a big thing, and you have people fall on it and everything. But yeah, I just feel like some of the most popular movies of the year would be nominated in that, and it's just it'd be a good way to get people to watch. I mean, they just announced casting finally, which is a step in the right direction. But again, they drag their feet instead of just saying like it's going to happen next year. It's like 2, 3 years away, and it's like, what the hell's the hold up? Like,
Well, and my response to that would be basically, if I'm starving and somebody gives me half a cup of rice, I'm not going to say it should be a full cup of rice, right? Like, we know the Oscars are going to fuck it up. There's no way they wouldn't fuck this up. But I'd rather have it and have them fuck it up than have it not exist at all, because getting through the door is the hardest part. And then you can tweak and put pressure on them in different ways. Because yeah, we know that once the stunt awards are, if the Oscars do give one, it's gonna be It's going to be kind of like the is it the SAG Stunt Awards that are always like
Yeah.
whatever fucking DC movie or Marvel movie or Mission Impossible always wins, like, which you can't fault Mission Impossible, but like we know they're going to fuck it up. They're not going to nominate Sniper Grit, so there's still always going to be room for what Vulture's doing here, but it's still at least it would be there, it would exist,
Yeah.
whereas now it doesn't even exist. We're starving in the desert and we don't even have a half a cup of stale rice.
Yeah.
So
One thing before we move on is I just want to shout out our performer of the year, Vincent Bouillon, who Aaron actually shouted this out on Twitter right around the same time that we were writing the article up. And I incorporated some of what he said in his tweet into the article because it was an important point to make. The stair fall, I think, is an instantly iconic stunt. I think in my write-up I said it's up there with like Jackie Stan, Jesus Christ, Jackie Chan's glass fall in the mall in Police Story, and like Buster Keaton having the house fall over him. I think that stair fall is an immediately iconic image in film history. And so many people were like, I can't believe Keanu did that. And it's like he didn't. It was Vincent Bouillon who did that. And I think I just really it was really fun to highlight him because I think whether people know it or not, he's like an immediately like an instantly iconic piece of cinema forever, in my opinion.
yeah, I think that's a good place to end it. I mean, that fall's legendary. I voted for Jeremy Marinus, but I also think that I'm gonna have lots of opportunities. Given where Jeremy's career is, we're gonna have
Oh
lots
yeah.
of opportunities for Jeremy to win Stunt Performer of the Year. He's gonna be, I mean, he's going through the roof. So it was probably a little premature. And like you said, iconic stunt from Bullion to go down
And
those stairs.
my final shout out is to Rachel McDermott, who was gonna butcher her name, but goal she's in Extraction too. I always butcher her name, but she was her stunt double, and I just she, I'm
Oh,
just gonna
Gossett
don't
Devarani,
go
yes. Go Chef Devarani, yeah.
Rachel McDermott was her stunt double, and she and I had a little bit of a correspondence together, and I just want to shout her out because she had my vote because like shit she did in that like oneer is unbelievable.
That was like some like raid level or some fucking like
Yeah.
Timo Chianto shit going on. Yeah, man. That was wow.
That oneer should have been given. Like, I wish we could have figured out a way to get that oneer its own special award because I know we're all sick of oneers, but that just seeing it and then talking to Sam Hargrave about how he accomplished it was like, it's unreal. And I don't think that movie got near the respect it deserved last year. It was written off as another Netflix movie, and it didn't deserve that.
I mean, it was a big hit for Netflix, so that's good. But I agree. I it definitely was. I mean, fucking Extraction 2, if people still haven't seen it yet, it's on a next level. It is, I think, as good as John Wick 4,
I
in terms
agree.
of stunts and action and just also just a good goddamn movie. Everybody knows I wasn't a huge fan of the first one. This one I really, really loved. I've watched it several times. It's kind of becoming a comfort action movie for me. So it's good shit. All right, let's move on. So, really only one big release this week. Vice is the only one that saw it, so we're going to turn it over to him. It's a belated sequel to a franchise that I actually think quality-wise is pretty damn exceptional. So I'm excited to see if this one continues. Kung Fu Panda 4. Vice, tell us what you thought.
No, I guess this is feel like one of those things where people like a sequel or some kind of like a IP, as it were, or some people are like, why is this getting made? And the answer is obviously because money. So like it's so that kind of I had some apprehension going into this. The Kung Fu Panda films as a whole, they're really good. It's surprisingly good even. Like I think people were like, when the original came out, people were really surprised at how well done it was. And it's and the if, for its time, the level of the animation, its quality was gorgeous. Gorgeous films. They really are kind of set the bar for like how animation can and should look. It's at a base level, like the kind of the gold standard. So I really enjoyed the first two. And the thing is, like these are like they're kid films, whatever. But like they're actually they these are legitimate martial arts films. They kind of the way they storyboard and present the animation or the fight scenes or just the action adventure fight scenes They're
Kung
legit.
Fu Kung Fu Panda 2 has Crocodile Jean-Claude Van Damme doing the splits. Sorry, that shit is legit. These movies are fucking legit. There's no way around it.
Yeah. So that said, though, so even though I've enjoyed them, I even forget now what year it was, but Kung Fu Panda 3, I kind of completely forgot what happened in that movie. So, and I think that kind of speaks to that part of the, you know, that kind of just the kind of the nature of sequels sometimes in general, like a kind of this loose steam. And it's not anybody's fault per se. It's like they don't really do anything wrong necessarily. It's that you kind of, in certain ways, you can only go so far with certain premises, I guess. This is the nature of stories in general. It's not a problem with one particular franchise or one particular genre. Just sometimes it's we're not sure to say, you know. Whereas like, you know, with horror films, it's kind of easy to like make, like, you know, there's like what, 12, 15 Jason movies or whatever, or however many fucking Halloween movies, who knows. But you know, it's some movies just aren't built for that. So, with that in mind, when I was going to see Kung Fu Panda 4, I wasn't expecting much, and turns out it's great. It's really good. It's really good. It's I think you know, talking about the issues of sequels, like in the case of these, like specifically these children animated films, it's very difficult to kind of keep that momentum of the whenever there's a groundbreaking family film, kid film, that does emotionally resonate really well with the audience and generations, that's hard to keep going over the years. So like the biggest example, not every movie can be a Toy Story, you know, that's made four films over the course of however many years, and they managed to with the time and effort make each of those stories have some kind of a emotional impact. They make themselves matter in a way. And to a lesser extent, things like the How to Train Your Dragon series, also great films, great family adventure films, and those have managed to kind of keep their momentum of like their emotional journeys relevant. Kung Fu Panda, not so much, because again, it's kind of like there's not really much more you can do, more or less. But I think in this case, they did find a way to like kind of give it a reason for existing, I guess. You know, it's Well, and I guess the main thing that it provides, as a piece of entertainment, as media, is that these are really well made, bright and inventive, and just well put together, well produced action adventure movies. War looks great. The action is sharp and crisp. But yeah, so I guess, well, you know what, I kind of want to. I was gonna just say, you know, not worry about spoilers, but honestly, I don't wanna. I'll give it the respect I think it earns. So I won't get into too much spoilers in this movie, but just to say that, in this movie, the main conceit is that, Kung Fu Panda, that black, he has now, you know, in the previous adventures, he gained wisdom and martial prowess as a dragon warrior, but now, I don't remember the turtle, Ugwe. Yeah, you know, he passed to the other side in part three, spoilers. So now part of the duty of the dragon warrior is to become the new spiritual leader. So he has to basically give up being the dragon warrior. And so with that, he has to, he's told he has to find a successor. But of course, him being, he wants to fight. He wants to skadoosh. So he doesn't want to give it up. But in the adventure, they find that they encounter an evil sorceress whose plan is to go into the spirit realm and capture the magic of martial arts for her own evil ends, whatever. It's so funny trying to describe this fucking spot in this movie. Oh no, I guess that's it. It's not too dissimilarly silly from any other martial arts film, I guess. So, you know.
That's the nice thing about Kung Fu Panda is they're basically fucking Shaw Brothers movies. I mean, they really are Shaw Brothers movies.
Yeah, so the main thrust of the movie is the Kung Fu Panda is trying to defeat the sorceress, and he ends up teaming up with this wayward fox, Zhen. This is played by Awkwafina. And so it's pretty much a buddy comedy, buddy action comedy between Jack Black and Awkwafina, kind of riffing with each other. Well, no, I won't say riffing. It doesn't feel like improv. It's really, you know, it's pretty much standard, comedy beats, whatever. So it's they play together well. They play off each other well. I guess I kind of say, like, if Jack Black is like the king of annoying cartoon voice characters, And Awkwafina is his heir apparent because he just is annoying. But, like, that's part of the fun of it all. Like, that's why they're like so famous as voice actors. Like, they can like go that extremity of being charmingly annoying, I guess is the
I
phrase.
have to chime in for 1 second and just say, I know she's like problematic for a variety of reasons, but she's like my big problematic fave. I think she's a terrific actor, and it sucks so much that like she can't help but be annoying because she's so good in The Farewell. I think she's better than Simu Liu and Shang-Chi, and like it's just she's always so good in everything, and I'm just like, why can't you just be normal?
But to that point, she's good here. She's putting in the work as like kind of be toe to toe with Jack Black, who's just a huge personality on his own. Yeah, but she holds her own. Oh yeah. So overall, again, without spoilers, it's really, I want to say basic, but I don't mean it in a bad way. I mean like at this point, they just kind of like keep things going. So it's a brisk pace. They take their time to catch their breath and have the emotional points where it needs to be. But it's not trying to get too heavy in like the themes or like maybe the first two were. So it's a little more lighthearted in that regard. But yeah, except the, oh, and the fights are great. Like actually, I did there's one scene where there's like a chase in the city. They find a new city. And they it's really funny. They do like a orchestral like Chinese instrumental version of Crazy Train, the Ozzy Osbourne song. It's a fun, like they're having fun with it. You can tell that even though it's like the fourth iteration now after so many years, you can tell that the creators. I don't want to speculate on if they're who's being forced to make movies or whatever, but you could definitely tell they're having a good time with this, everybody involved with it. So at least it has that and is going for it. And yeah, it's again nothing too heavy, nothing too like groundbreaking. Like, there's like a in the same again to comparison, where Toy Story 4 kind of came after years and like kind of reinvigorated it, that emotional burst, the passing of the torch, or the passing of the Woody to the doll to the little girl. Like there's nothing heavy like that per se, but it's kind of keeping things light and still trying to, I guess. Well, that's the other thing I was thinking about. Is like who are these movies for? I mean, obviously it's for kids, it's a kid movie, but I mean, like I was wondering because it's been actually I don't remember if you could check for me when the first film came out. I believe it was 2007, but I might be wrong. But just in general, like and I know that between that first film, there's been like TV series and like this very merchandise, whatever. So like the
2008.
Kung Fu. Okay, good. Yeah. So not too long. But so I was just wondering, like do kids who remember that back then so remember this now, or is there a new generation of kids who like kind of getting to it? And yeah, I guess it's kind of one of those like elastic properties that it's a Kung Fu Panda. Like kids are gonna love that no matter what. They don't need to see their first movie or whatever. It's a big ass panda doing kung fu kicks. Like, what more do you need? That's all the buy-in you need. So in that regard, yeah. As I'm watching it, in the theater, the kids are going, they're loving it. They're having a good time. I hear the parents laughing too. Some of the jokes, which are not the best, but it's again, it's an easygoing movie. It's meant to be like go down easy. They're not trying to like challenge anybody too much here.
Well, it's fascinating you bring that up because last year with Puss in Boots, The Last Wish, I have to still see it, but it's one of those things with that because they are also both DreamWorks films. That and Kung Fu Panda, they have a period of where they don't really have any releases. So with Puss in Boots last year, it was 10 years between that and the last film. So the one before that came out in 2012, and then with Kung Fu Panda, the last one that came out before this one was in 2016, Kung Fu Panda 3. So it's what, 8 years? 8 years since the last one. So there's something, what you're saying, I wouldn't say that there's necessarily cultural irrelevancy, but it's one of those because it's been away for so long that I'm like, wait, we're on the fourth film? I thought they were done. That sort of idea. But yeah,
Well,
continue.
DreamWorks has really done a good job, I think, of. I really used to hate DreamWorks movies, to be DreamWorks animated movies, because I know I can hear the gasps already. I fucking hate Shrek. I hate Shrek. I can't
it's
stand
terrible.
Shrek.
It's terrible.
Hold up.
It's all nostalgia. We all saw it when we were 12.
I fucking hate it. And it ruined DreamWorks movies because it all became these fucking dollar store Looney Tunes pop culture references.
But then
Kung Fu Panda and How to Train Your Dragon came out. And DreamWorks really found a nice niche of doing these fairly lighthearted movies, but that also managed to punch you straight in the feels. Just fucking punch you. Like, How to Train Your Dragon 3 still, to this day, has me bawling like a child, you know? Mm-hmm. And then the Puss in Boots movies, even though they sprung from Shrek, did do the same thing. They have that same sort of formula where DreamWorks, I used to not like them because they were irony overload. And now they've actually gone the other way to where they're just completely earnest and completely sincere in all these movies that they put out. And it sounds like Kung Fu Panda 4 is the same. And really, honestly, that's all I could ask for out of a Kung Fu. If I go see Kung Fu Panda 4, I want Kung Fu Panda 4. I'm not looking for it to break new ground or change anything. I want to laugh a little bit at Jack Black doing Kung Fu. I want to get tugged on my heartstrings a little bit. And I want to leave the movie feeling better than I was when I went in. And that's really all I'm aiming for out of it. And it sounds like it pretty much does that.
Yeah, it delivers. It checks the boxes. It does just that. You know, it's like I said, like I don't know if there's like Kung Fu Panda super fans out there or whatever, like Star Wars fans. I don't know if there's a big Kung Fu Panda mania going on or whatever, but I don't know if that'll like, it'll satisfy you in that regard, but like, I mean, it's just, it does what it says on the tin and it's a good time. One thing I want to mention is like, so I mentioned the animation, like they always have this high level of production. So interesting, like as I'm watching the action adventure scenes, again, they're really high quality, but I did get the feeling of like, I don't know, I was like, is that all? And I realized as I thought about it afterwards, like I thought that because, you know, there's been like over the past several years, some pretty big leaps in animation. Specifically, probably the most notable is the Spider-Verse films. The way they do the various techniques of animation is kind of really groundbreaking on their own, and then like the way they do the frame differentiation, and just the wild kinetic stuff going on in the visuals. So if you see this, going from like Spider-Verse 2 to this, it's understandable why it might feel like a downgrade, but it's really not. Like again, the movie Panda isn't doing anything wrong per se. It's just that it's still its same mold. It's just that, you know, other things, like even last year from the Teenage Mutant Turtles Mayhem, again, kind of doing really out there with the animation. Seeing things that are doing more experimental, more kind of out there things might make this seem, I don't know, quaint in comparison, but it's not really, it's really not. It really still has the same level of quality it always has. It's just that, you know, it's in the time frame we're in that it might seem that way.
Well, and just kind of like Disney, DreamWorks does have a bit of a house style in terms of their animation design. So it kind of makes sense that it's going to, you know, it's not going to be as groundbreaking or cutting edge as like Spider-Verse.
So, like I said, I had a good time overall. I think it's a solid entry, you know. Oh, the last thing I do want to talk to Viola Davis. She's playing the bad person, the chameleon. She's like an evil sorceress. And it's just, I love it when like these master level actors do clownery for the kids. Like I just love seeing, like, you know, way back to, like, you know, when Max von Sydow was in Flash Gordon, or, you know, when Frank Langella was in Scaleless Gordon, He-Man, the motion picture. Like, you get these like these high level, master level actors, like the true thespians, like true like icons of the craft. Just saying the silliest shit. It's so fun. And especially even more fun when you can see they enjoy it. Like you can tell, like Viola Davis, she's having a good time. She's like just kind of like rolling her, like she has like this kind of, well, being a chameleon, she kind of adds this like reptilian attitude to her voice to it. It's really fun to see her work, even in something like this. But again, saying that, I mean to disparage, I just mean like you wouldn't expect that. You know, you might think it's like, oh, it's just a paycheck, whatever. No, she's in it. She's invested in the work, and She's doing the comedy for the kids. Really great. I remember last year we talked about when Michelle Yeoh was in Transformers as Eraser. Just saying the dumbest shit, like literally no sense. But it's Michelle Yeoh. You love it. Same here. Like I just love hearing Viola Davis just act, no matter what she's in. And it's the same here. So it's really cool that she did that.
You just reminded me. I don't want to forget it because I know this podcast will especially agree. One of my mutuals tweeted earlier today that it's pretty crazy that Leonard Nimoy's best performance outside of Spock is probably in Transformers: Dark of the Moon, and I agree with that. I think he's incredible in that movie. It's like, I mean, I don't know if he's like as like a high level actor as those guys because he was always sort of in schlock, but I still think he has a bit of gravitas that
Yeah.
kind of coincides with your point.
Well, and
Yeah, and that
that
was it.
actually
Like,
will. Sorry, go ahead, Vice.
I'll just say and but to be fair, the kids deserve that. They
They do,
should get
yeah.
like, these actors performing the craft for them. Like they're still like, movie lovers all the same in their own way. They're not like, they don't have Criterion accounts, but like they still they're coming to see the movies, with their family. They want to enjoy the experience. And, like I appreciate when these actors of such high caliber offer that performance for the kids. It makes That's what makes movie fans in the future. Like you have a kid now who's seeing this cool actor or hearing their performance, and that'll grab them into the future. So yeah, I really appreciate when you do the silly shit like this.
I don't know, maybe it's pretentious that kids like Kung Fu Panda instead of The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. I'm just saying. No, I'm just kidding. I as a joke, I do agree with you, Mike, about that early half of DreamWorks is it's pretty bad. And I haven't seen Shrek in years. It's fun for the memes, but like that's kind of all I really think about it. But you're correct. Like once we get to Kung Fu Panda and How to Train Your Dragon, they've really stepped their game up around there.
They do. Well, they just, yeah, like I said, they kind of, when Shrek was such a massive hit, they sort of really steered into that sort of, again, that irony based, because the first DreamWorks animated movie was Prince of Egypt, the most fucking earnest, sincere movie that's ever been fucking made.
Fucking masterpiece, what
And
it is, yeah. That's a legit masterpiece, man.
yeah, and but then Shrek was that was actually a failure, and then Shrek was a massive hit. And now I feel like they've found a really nice balance in terms of still bringing the funny, but also bringing the sincerity. So yeah, it sounds like good
So
stuff.
I'll just close it off saying, yeah, if you're like dreading it, whatever, if you get like your kid, a dragon kid, like don't worry, it'll be fine. You'll have a good time. It's not gonna blow your brains out. But yeah, if you're a Kung Fu Panda super fan, I guess, I don't know, I think you'll still be enjoy it, But yeah, it's a good time at the movies. Take the kids, go chill out, and go to Olive Garden afterward. You have a good time. It's good.
All right. I gotta jump into the DTV realms for a few minutes here. I finally watched Red Right Hand. For those who don't know, it's the new release from Asbury Park, who we've talked about on this show before. It's Basil Iwanyk's DTV. He's trying to make a DTV Blumhouse, basically. They're partnered with Redbox. They make movies directly for Redbox. Their first big release was My Beloved Blacksite, which, as they also were the production company behind Silent Night. They've put out a few other movies. This is their most recent one. It's directed by, well, it stars, most importantly, it stars Orlando Bloom, entering his DTV realm. And it also stars my boy Garrett Dillahunt. It's directed by the Nelms brothers, who are probably most well known for directing that Mel Gibson movie Fat Man that came out a couple years ago, where he's Santa, Bronson Santa, basically. But they directed a pretty terrific movie in 2017 called with John Hawkes called Small Town Crime that is actually well worth watching. They're pretty nasty in terms of they're very 70s, very gritty directors, and Red Right Hand is no exception to that. This is not a standard DTV high level action movie. This is much more of something that you would expect to star Robert Mitchum and come out in like 1974. The plot is basically Orlando Bloom plays a farmer. He and his brother-in-law and his niece are trying to keep their farm together. in this small town in Kentucky, which is the one thing I will warn everybody about. Orlando Bloom's Kentucky accent ultimately ends up being fine, but it's fucking jarring when he first starts talking. It takes it really does blast you out of the movie for a second. It's not even that it's bad necessarily. It's just that you know what Orlando Bloom is supposed to sound like, and fucking Legolas does not talk like fucking Boyd Crowder. Like that's just there's some disconnect there. But what you ultimately find out is that the brother-in-law is in debt to this drug lord that owns the town, played by Andy McDowell, in a absolutely blisteringly bitchy performance, like just amazingly fucking evil, which is great. God love Andy McDowell for steering into that. Like, and so, you know, as expected, shit gets fucky. And Orlando Bloom has to, he used to work for, this isn't really a spoiler, he used to work for Andy McDowell. So he's got skills, but he's not like, we're not talking about, again, a John Wick kind of thing. We're talking more about, he's just a thug who's really good at killing people. And it goes from there. Lots of, not a ton of action. The violence is really brutal. There is a scene, just to warn people, where somebody's getting tortured and their legs are hit with sledgehammers and you see their femurs pop up and break through their skin as their legs are broken. So it's a nasty, nasty little movie. But I dug it. I thought it was pretty fucking good. Like I said, if you're really into that, if you're into that sort of 70s, Charles Bronson, Robert Mitchum, Rolling Thunder kind of vibe. That's really what this is. And it's not a movie that I'm going to revisit a ton, if at all. It is a little bit of a slow burn. It's almost two full hours. It probably didn't need to be quite two full hours. It could have probably been about 15 minutes shorter because it is a bit of a slow burn. But when it pops off, it pops off. You're not going to be disappointed about that. So long as, again, you're expecting nasty, dirty fighting, not like, you know, Scott Adkins level stuff. But yeah, I dug it. It's another solid entry from Asbury Park. I don't think it's quite as great as Black Sight, which, again, I wouldn't shut up about when that came out. But this is another really solid entry. It's well worth, I'd actually say it's well worth even renting on Vudu or iTunes. I don't know. You know, like last week I said, wait for Snow White and the Seven Samurai to come to Tubi. This one's well worth, this one I was happy to pay my $12 or $14 or whatever it was to buy. I enjoyed it. I got my money's worth. So that's our DTV corner this week. Solid recommendation. Came out a couple weeks ago. It took me a while to get to it because I've been wanting to watch it for a while. But yeah, I for one am very excited to see Orlando Bloom enter his DTV era, because I think he's very convincing. They got him all tatted up. He's jacked. He looks like he's about 25 years older than he should be. You know, I mean, he's getting that, like, almost that like Van Damme craggy face with the sad eyes and the wrinkles in the cheeks and stuff like that. So I don't know if that's what he looks like, because he didn't look like that in Gran Turismo. So I don't know if it's makeup or if he's just had a really hard year, there is some miles on that face, and it really does work. And then again, like I said, Garrett Dillahunt plays the town preacher, who's also got some secrets, and he is one of my favorite that guy actors, and he knocks it out of the park in this one like he always does. He's never anything but fucking great in everything he's in. So I got to give this one a rec. I think it's a solid movie, so I think y'all should check it out. B, I especially think it might be on your wavelength. I think you might actually dig it.
I've been hovering over it for a bit. It's on my Prime watch list to rent, so you've convinced me.
Yeah, let me know when you watch it, because I'll be really curious to see what you think of it. But
yeah, definitely.
I got two things. One, you said it. It's kind of like Robert Mitchum. So yeah. you got me to watch Yakuza after I saw Night of the Hunter a few years ago. So I'll be looking for that. Two, do they Yakuza's play Red so Right good. Hand?
They don't. They did not actually get the money
Four
to play
stars.
Red Right Hand.
Four
So for
stars.
those wondering why it's called that, it's actually a relative, it's a plot point in the movie, even though it was driving me nuts that they didn't play Red Right Hand. Is
That would put it in the Scream universe, though, if they played it.
everybody that works for Andie MacDowell has some sort of mark. She burns them to show that she owns them. And Orlando Bloom's was he she made him stick his hand in a fire, so he's got his right hand is burned and literally a burned red right hand. So that's where it comes from. So I appreciate the literalism of it, even though they didn't play the song. But yeah, it's they could have gotten a cover at least, I think. But I don't know. That song is so iconic for Scream purposes. Even though it also played in Hellboy, it is so iconic for Scream purposes. But yeah, I dug it. So that's all I got on that one. And then the final, I guess the next to last thing we'll talk about, and Brandon, I don't think Liam's gonna join us. Do you want to hold off on Sting?
Yeah, we can. I just want to say real quick because I just saw his message too. Just thanks for all the memories, Sting. He was probably my first favorite wrestler, and I think that's all Liam and I were gonna have. We were gonna have a little wrestling corner, but maybe that can be for another day, or it
Yeah.
can stay in my DMs with him, where we just talk about heel rock all day.
He was a legend. There's no way around it. And he's one of the few that was able to actually successfully reinvent his character in a way that a lot of wrestlers don't, because he never really went back. He became Crow Sting and he never really went back. A lot of wrestlers, when they reinvent themselves, they end up going back to their old, whatever their first, like Hogan went back to Hulk Hogan after Hollywood Hogan. But for Sting, it stuck.
And he's like the one, he's the one guy that you only hear good stories about in an industry filled with like the worst people alive. Like he's the one guy that like it just seems like he has his head on his shoulders. Like he even talked about it just really quick, a brief aside, at after his final match, he was in the press conference and they brought up how he had teamed with Ultimate Warrior when in his younger days before all the Sting stuff and everything. They were the Blade Runners together. And he said that, he flat out said, I did steroids and I stopped doing them in 1990. And then he said Ultimate Warrior kept doing them and he went on a different path. But I mean, even steroids and stuff like that, he seems like he was one of the only people in that industry to have come out the other side with his head on his shoulders.
So it's the end. And for those who don't follow wrestling, he's not dead. He's retired.
Yeah.
So that was because when you first tweeted about it, I had to fucking
Oh, yeah.
scramble because I'm like, oh shit, is he did he
No,
die?
no,
What?
no. Yeah, he had his big retirement match. 64 years old, going through tables still. Like it's crazy.
And still able to do it in a way that, say, some other wrestlers like the carcass of the Undertaker and some of these other guys have not, were not able to do. He's retiring while he could still move.
I want to give my publicly hot take right here, and then we can move on from wrestling. Everyone wanted the Sting Undertaker match for years and years. Undertaker never deserved that. He's the most overrated wrestler in my lifetime. I don't know when he put on MMA gloves in like 2005 and started to convince everyone he could actually go. He sucks. I hate the Undertaker.
Throwing the heat. There we go. There we go. Wouldn't be a wrestling podcast if we didn't have some heat.
Of course you had good matches with Shawn Michaels. I mean, come on. I'm sorry. I hate the Undertaker, but we can talk.
All right, last thing we're going to talk about is Brandon and I watched the big Netflix release this week. It's so big that I wasn't even aware that it was out until somebody on the Discord informed me of it. But it is a
Same.
big movie.
Same.
It's a big movie. The new Millie Bobby Brown starring Damsel, for those who haven't seen it, directed by Juan Carlos Fresnadillo. So it actually has a real director, a real talented director. And I do think that shows in the movie a bit, but the plot is it's a subversion of a fairy tale trope. Millie Bobby Brown plays a daughter of the head of this small village or smallish village, who is asked to marry the prince from a large kingdom and to be his princess, only to find out that she is set to be a sacrifice to a dragon, and she is thrown down a giant pit and has to square off against this dragon, which actually the one thing I will well thing I will say, Vice, is going back to what you said about Viola Davis. This is the dragon's voiced by Agadashloo, and she is fucking relishing this role. She is just tearing into it, and that's actually a big part of what appeal the movie does have. But I will not get too far into my thoughts. I'll give Brandon the floor first.
So I was kind of bored by it the whole time, but then talking to you before we started recording, I kind of put it into perspective for me that like this movie isn't like terrible. It's not even it is what it is. Like I think every generation deserves their mindless Dragonheart because I don't think Dragonheart is as good if you were to go. It's no Reign of Fire, I'll say that.
But what is really?
Yeah,
What is?
exactly. But I love Dragonheart as a kid, so I could see a kid, who's a Stranger Things fan popping this on and, having a good time with it. I watched it because I thought there would be more action. There really isn't much, if at all. But it has a fun cast. Ray Winstone and Angela Bassett play her parents, which was really fun casting. But my one thing is like, of course, it has the Netflix sheen and everything, so it doesn't look great. But I mean, I think most people know that going into a Netflix movie at this point that it's not it's gonna look like what it looks like. But the one thing I'll say is I think Millie Bobby Brown's a pretty terrific actress. I mean, I like everyone else like was blown away by her first season performance in Stranger Things. I haven't kept up with that show. I don't even know what season they're on now. They're probably like 36 years old on that show, but I like. Like I don't, but I remember that first season being like, wow, this kid is incredible. And I think that she's shown that prom. I think the Enola Holmes movies are really fun. I think that, but it's frustrating that she seems to be like locked in Netflix's basement. And it's like, I think she could be like, we talk about movie stars and stuff. I think she has a real future if she gets out of whatever this Netflix contract is where she only gets to make movies with them or Godzilla. But I mean, I think she's pretty good in this movie. I think. But you set it off, Mike, that couldn't help but think of another streaming princess movie from a year or two ago, which was The Princess, and that is, if you're looking for action, that's gives you everything you need. This one kind of fell very flat for me, but I also wasn't the intended audience. I thought I might be when I first read about it, and then as I was watching it, I was like, oh, this isn't for me. So, and I try to be a little nicer to movies like that now.
Yeah, I mean that's I watched it and I thought it was fine. We talked about it a little bit. I think the biggest problem is what it really reminds. I like the Dragonheart analogy. That's a really strong analogy for sort of the quality level of this movie, where you have a very charismatic lead actor, Dennis Quaid, Millie Bobby Brown, and a very very
I'm always
well.
comparing those two in my head
Yeah,
right now.
aren't we all? Aren't we all? And a very, very game, invested, famous voice actor, really tearing into the roles of the dragons with Sean Connery and Shura Agadashloo, and a lot of fairly mediocre stuff surrounding them. Sorry to Dragonheart fans, it's not Reign of Fire,
Look, all right, hold up. I like Reign of Fire, okay? Like, it's good, but I rewatched it back in January. It does drag a bit in the middle.
It
Like,
does not
the
drag
thing
a bit in
everybody
the
remembers is Matthew McConaughey with that axe that he uses
middle.
once,
No,
and he
what I
gets.
remember is envy the country that has heroes, heh, and pity
All
the
right, yeah,
country
that's
that
good.
needs
Good.
them.
For Dragonheart, really quick, I'll say one of the first movies I ever reviewed as a freelance writer after I stopped doing my own blog was I got an early screener of Dragonheart 5, and I had no idea there were three sequels previous to that, and I loved it. So, I mean, this is a DTV podcast first and foremost, and I don't know, the fifth Dragonheart movie is pretty worth watching. But anyway.
My biggest issue with Damsel, and this is a perfect example of it, is it for, like you said, Brandon, for the yes queen girl boss kick ass princess movie, it's the princess does it better. for the subversion of fairy tale tropes, Frozen does it better. And for the Millie Bobby Brown just kind of being kick-ass movie star, the Enola Holmes movies do it better. So this is really less than the sum of its parts. And that's the biggest thing. But for me, the other movies it made me think of were those sort of 2000 era Disney, Nicolas Cage Sorcerer's Apprentice kind of Disney era movies, the Stephen Sommers 94 Jungle Book. It kind of has that vibe. And for a certain target audience, I think it's going to be pretty entertaining. I wasn't really bored. There wasn't a ton of action. Robin Wright's doing a pretty good job tearing it up as like the evil queen. Nick Robinson as the prince is suitably dull. He's exactly as dull as he's supposed to be.
Is that was that love? I didn't look it up. Was that the Love Simon guy? Was that him, Love Simon himself? He looked familiar to me, but I couldn't place it.
I think it might be. I remember him most from Jurassic World, but yeah, it is love. He is Love Simon. Yeah, he is Simon.
I'm
So
gonna spoil something very quickly. I don't think I'm giving anything away in 3, 2, 1 spoilers. I hope neither of you care, Max or Vice, but I mean, there's an evil queen in this movie. Of course, she dies. And I'll just say that Robin Wright has a terrific death scene. It's actually, this movie, I will say, is much, when there are moments of violence, they're much more violent than I was
yeah.
expecting. Her death is violent, and there's a horse death in this that I was like, whoa, holy shit. Like, they're
It's
just.
definitely pushing the PG-13, because it's Netflix, it's not really rated, but it would be a PG-13, but it's definitely
Yeah.
kind of pushing the PG-13.
That was one
They're
nice
also
surprise.
not shy because they essentially spoil in the trailers that the kingdom sacrifices her. So
Yeah, I
I
mean,
think they very much let up that
you
they
have to
can.
spoil that, right? That's the hook of the movie, even though it takes a half an hour to get to it. That's
Really?
yeah,
Yeah, it
that's
takes
damn.
way too long to get to the talking dragon, like way too
Yeah.
long.
Yeah.
That's a
It
sin.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's something you do in the first 15 minutes. Like, what
Yeah.
are we doing here?
Yeah, it well, I mean, you got to set up. It's kind of like they do in Frozen, it follows that template. You got to set up the prince. Millie Bobby Brown doesn't want to go into this marriage, but she's agreed to, but you got to set up the prince wooing her, and she actually falls in love with him just to get betrayed. Again, I don't care about spoilers for this because there's not a plot point in this movie that you will not see coming from a mile away. Even the big twist, which is of course that the dragon is not as evil as we're expecting, and in fact is has been duped just like Millie Bobby Brown has. You'll see that coming a mile away. There's just isn't anything, but it's Fresnadillo, so it's very competently done. Even though I agree with Brandon, it does have that kind of Netflix sheen. The blocking, the shot selection, some of that stuff is really well done. Nothing quite as inventive as what he does in 28 Weeks Later. But obviously it's also not the same kind of movie. You're not going to have a helicopter chopping up lots of zombies in a PG-13 movie called Damsel. But I don't know. I didn't hate it. I did not hate it at all. I kind of enjoyed it. I think the best thing to say is, like you said, Brandon, I'm not the target audience, but if I knew somebody who was in the target audience, if I had a 13-year-old niece who loved Millie Bobby Brown, hell yeah, watch the shit out of this. It's not Enola Holmes. You're probably not going to like it as much as Enola Holmes, but watch the shit out of it. You're gonna probably enjoy it. And she's got to carry Brown's got to carry the entire movie on her shoulders, and she does. I mean, that's all there is to it. She is a natural born star, and there's just nothing else to it. So yeah, for me, weak recommendation, but a recommendation. I fall on the recommend line of the list. So Brandon's a little, it sounds like you're a little more
You
on the negative line, but.
you've talked me into, being a little bit nicer to it, because like I think part of the reason was that it was like 7:30 in the morning and I'm turning this on and I'm like have my coffee and I'm like, what the fuck am I doing with my life? I could be sleeping,
You know what it sounds like? It sounds to me, as even as a weak recommendation, it sounds like if you have a friend, you got a roommate, or you're with your partner, girlfriend, boyfriend, what have you, it sounds like an easygoing, I can't figure out what to watch her own damsel.
This
Yeah.
is this
no
is
fuss, no muss.
And you might talk a little bit during it and stuff. Like, yeah.
Yeah, this is a Tuesday night watch, not a Friday night watch. Yeah. This is not a sit down Friday. We're gonna watch Dune or whatever. This is a fuck, it's Tuesday. We don't know what to watch, but we want to watch a movie.
I got leftovers in the fridge.
I got leftovers. Heat up some cold pizza, watch fucking Damsel. You're going to be fine. You're going to be fine. There's just nothing. This is one of those movies. I've seen some responses on Twitter that are pretty vitriolic about it. And it is one of those movies where I kind of look and go, like, barring I get watching it at 7:30 and wondering, but in terms of the actual movie, I just don't think there's enough here to be vitriolic about.
Exactly. Yeah. Like I tossed off something a little mean spirited on Letterboxd, but that's because I'm not really taking Letterboxd seriously anymore. And I just say whatever I say, what's on my mind. I'm a straight shoot and I'm just joking, but, but I did see some other Letterboxd reviews that were like very angry. And I'm like, how do you get, like, this movie leaves your head the minute you are done watching it. Like, there's no reason to be angry about it. It's like, no. Come on.
Yeah.
That's the world we live in now. It's every movie we see is either the greatest thing you've ever seen or the biggest piece of shit ever. And it's like, most movies aren't either of those things.
And I feel
unless
like
it's the Headhunter.
True. The Headhunter rocks. The Headhunter is the best movie I've ever seen.
And I feel like it's especially true with a Netflix movie. I feel like it's, and look, Lord knows I fucking hate Red Notice with the best of them, but by and large, Netflix does put out fine movies, right?
Most of their movies will disappear from your head, and like, yeah. You're just, that's just what you're gonna get from them from now on, unless it's one of their
prestige
or like one of their
international ones, like
like 60 Minutes was fun, and
Badlands. Well, so Netflix is not a love hate issue, but there's enough diamonds in the shit that I can dig out the diamonds.
Yeah.
Be mad about it.
Yeah. All right, boys. Well, we're going on almost 2 hours. I think this is probably a good time to wrap it up. So any last thoughts from anybody before we get into plugs? All right. B, where can people find you?
Just on Twitter under my name. I'm taking a little bit of a break from writing for a couple weeks or month or so, just trying to, you know, decompress. But yeah, all that, you can find me on Twitter, but all of the Vulture stuff I think is well worth checking out, not even just for the awards or anything I wrote, but just, you know, if you're listening to this podcast, like, there's so much in that Action issue. If you just Google Vulture Action, it's the first thing that comes up, and there's a whole hub, and then you'll see Jake Gyllenhaal running in slow motion on the cover and everything. And yeah, just seek that out. That's what I'll direct you towards, because there's a lot of fun writing there, and I'm just hoping that it keeps getting bigger and bigger to the point where maybe by year five, I'm handing out real awards to people somewhere, you know, wearing a nice suit.
Nice. Maxie, where can people find you?
You can find me on Twitter, basically any and all social media besides Instagram and Facebook. Usually variation of ODSD Spartan. Join the A4E Discord. I am the community manager. We'll put out the link this week, another link for people to join. And I'm recording tomorrow night with Diego and Gene over at Waffle Press, where we're doing like a sort of post-Oscars talk about, and I'll be up at 4 a.m. So yeah.
Nice. Vice, where can people find you?
You can find me in the dojo getting enlightenment with punches and kicks. Man, this karate shit is crazy, man. Like my knees hurt so bad, but like, cause you know, I'm old as fuck. I have arthritis and tendonitis. Like, you know, again, like, it's one thing to be, it's hilarious on its face to be a fat 40-year-old man doing karate as with the 5-year-old kids. Like, that's just ridiculous, man, how you look at it. But then, like, then the fact that it hurts so much, that's really, like, the real humbling thing. It's like, oh my God, what am I doing with my life? But at the same time, though, like, I definitely feel better. I definitely feel like it's working, you know, moving my body in a new way. So, yeah, I'm in the streets, in the dojo. Don't fight me, though. Well, you can fight me, but I got something for you. Not the Dark Party.
Throw a Kamehameha at you.
Take my camera, yeah. So I'm on Instagram, Big Hot. You see my pictures there, doing my karate skills. I'm on Letterboxd. I'll put my review. I forgot to put my Dune 2 review, so I'll put that and my Kung Fu Panda 4 review there as well. And then, yeah, as always, so one of us does. I'm on Twitter, talking other shit.
You can find Liam on Twitter and Instagram at Liam Odin. He is currently still hard at work editing Warpath. And so, you know, we'll look for an update for that soon. You can find me at Hibachi Justice everywhere. And you can find the show A4E Podcast everywhere. Linktree/A4E Podcast. You're listening to us, so you know you can find us anywhere podcasts can be found. Boys, love you. Let's do this again next week.
Yes.
See you then. Bye.